ya lo hace, pierna derecha, directo al arco, golazo, golazo.
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Monday, November 26th, 2018, Cyber Monday. It is the day where we all spend way too much on online.
I don't spend anything. I have a reasonable shopping habit.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I don't really need anything. I got, like, four TVs in the studio, and I got, like, everything I need. So I don't need to spend more today.
No, precisely. That is exactly what I would have to say about that. But, I mean, if you want to, I do, you know, my 9-to-5 right now is selling CRM, which is primarily a sales platform for a lot of companies. So buy.
Speaking of Cyber Monday selling and letting go of a lot of old furniture or old unuseful or useless piece of technology, the Vancouver Whitecaps released a bunch of players today. Breck Shea, no more. Well, it's not on the lineup today, but I thought it was interesting. MDS made his first roster moves in Vancouver.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense if you're going to rebuild that team. And I think NDS's strength over the years, as we said when he was first announced, is to sort of get more from less. And Breck Shea is the exact opposite. It's like trying to get more from more, you know, trying to get more from like this pile that's gold, and you scrape it a little bit and it's fool's gold. That's kind of what Breck Shea is a little bit in this league. And that's maybe a little harsh because he does have qualities, but he just doesn't have the qualities that justifies the salary that he has. So not a surprising move. And certainly it's not a surprising move in a general sense that MDS is making moves, because I think they're going to strip that team down to the bone. They had to after that, you know, the way that the season ended, you might as well scrape it down and rebuild from the start. It doesn't take long in this league. You know, if you can get rid of enough salary, you can rebuild in a single offseason. So you might as well.
If you have budget. Oh, yeah. They have the Davies budget. So we'll see. On today's show, we'll talk about the U17 Women's World Cup, where Canada defeated Germany and Canada is off to the semifinal versus Mexico. We'll talk about this. We'll talk about the Copa Libertadores fiasco this weekend. This was terrible. On Saturday, Boca Juniors bus attacked by River Plate's fans. It's a small section of fans that attacked them in the streets, but because of the violence in the streets, there was some tear gas, and the tear gas went all the way into the bus and got trapped into the bus, and the players were affected. Some players got injuries because of broken glass. It was terrible. And the handling of it was terrible, too. But let's start the show, Dwayne, by talking about Major League Soccer playoffs. It's back. Two games yesterday. Atlanta versus New York in Atlanta. And Portland, Kansas City in Portland. Let's start with the earlier game. Atlanta 3, New York 0. That's so Metro.
Well, yeah, I mean, you'd want to avoid the easy joke, but sometimes when they set it up on a platter for you, what are you supposed to do? This was a remarkable game in many ways. And look, I think New York kind of got screwed by what I think was a bit of a pedantic VAR call that took back their away goal. And even having that one away goal would have made a major difference in that second leg. But they lost it. And it's more to the point, the way they started that game, the way they defended. This is a team that defined itself on how strong and how solid it was defensively. And they just did not turn up. Now, I think that NYRB fans can maybe point to the international break, and they didn't get, in their mind, a fair sort of shake. Their players were away more than the Atlanta players, that they were a little more stressed than the Atlanta players. And that's part of the reason why I think MLS wants to move away from having that break. It's not just a momentum thing. It's also a competition fairness thing, because you know, when you look at teams that have a lot of U.S. internationals and they're off in those breaks playing, and this affected Toronto a couple, you know, in 2016 and 2017, they were able to get through it, but not so much in 2017, but 2016 it did. Certainly, it's just a competition fairness thing, and New York might have been affected by that. But that first goal, look at that first goal, the way they shut off defensively and can't give Atlanta that type of space. That's what they're best at. They're great at finding those channels and finding that space. And if you shut off, you're going to get burned, and they got burned. And 3-0, it's hard to see a way back from that. If it was 2-0, if it was 3-1 especially, if it was 3-1, you know, what we'd say, yeah, it wasn't ideal, but you know, a 2-0 win and you're through, right? And it's a much different game. And I don't know, Kevin, if you want to give your thoughts before I jump in and start knocking on VAR again, which is a broken record, but
which is like a traditional thing on the show. Dwayne complains about VAR once every couple of weeks, and it's that time. But that, me, it's that third goal where Villalba shot a nice little left rocket low that got into with a nice little curl to it, and it just got into the net in the third goal, and that one could have been avoided. Of course, Luis Robles' view was a bit screened, I would say, not in the way you're going to talk about, but it's a screen in the actual run of play, the way it happened. His defender was in front of him, the shot was coming from about 25 yards out, and it found a way into the net. That goal is the one that hurts if I'm New York, because 2-0, like you mentioned, you just go back home, you score 2 goals, and it's back on level terms. But 3-0, you need to score 3 at home, and you have no away goal. So if Atlanta scores 1, you're in deep, deep, deep trouble.
No, and you know what? That isn't when the away goals is in effect. That is the biggest thing with a 3-0 loss. You could go on and conceivably think you could turn around and win by three at home. I mean, that's a big win, but it's conceivable. But what is really hard to see is winning by 5 at home and 1 goal, and suddenly that's what you're looking at, because they have the advantage and you need to score 5. So it's pretty much done at that point. So, you know, it's really it's hard to see a way back from this. You know, book your tickets to Atlanta. That's where the MLS Cup's going to be.
It's going to be a nice place, a nice time, a nice week in Atlanta. Wish I was going this year, but unfortunately, I have a wedding next year, so I can't afford to go to Atlanta right now, which is unfortunate, because it's a nice little break from the winter, which started a month early here in Canada.
Yeah, well, yes and no, it's raining here today, but anyway, it's like we're having an English winter. But no, exactly, it's... You're going, yeah, I can't see a way, but look, if they do come back from 3-0 down, then that's so Metro is dead, because they have, you know, gone that from, they've dealt from that. I mean, TFC came from 3-0 back famously against Montreal, but they got the 2 goals on the road to start that comeback, right? So you can come back from 3-0 down in a series like this, but it's just so hard to think with the away rule and everything else. And maybe this is another example to go back to the conversation I just had a minute ago with maybe we do need to go to the single knockout to give every advantage to the teams that finish above. So, you know, should New York have not have been hosting that game? Is it fair that they had to play in the break, you know, coming off of an international break where their players were more stretched than the Atlanta players? Is it fair that they had to play that first leg in a row? Maybe they even just give, if they're going to go to 2-leg series still, then maybe give the higher seeded team the choice of whether they want to play, because I think some teams would rather play that first leg at home, especially if the road or on at home is what, yeah. I'm saying, they'd rather have the advantage off the top, especially when you don't have to worry about away goals counting as the first tiebreaker in the stoppage and the extra time if it gets tied, as Portland fan or players should well know by now.
It's fascinating. Sorry, let's go and move to VAR. And it was 1-0. The Red Bulls thought they scored a goal, but the view of Brad Guzan was screened by a player who was offside, and they decided to call this with VAR, and the goal was taken back.
Yeah, I called it. They never call, ever. Look, ever. That is never called in this. And it wasn't even, I think it was a ridiculous call. I think it was absolutely a stunningly ridiculous call in my mind. Yes, he was in an offside position. Yes, maybe the view was blocked a little bit, but he didn't touch the ball. He did not actively even move towards the ball. That is typically how they call that. This is absolutely 100% in no logical interpretation of what clear and obvious error means. Being defined by way. It is not a clear and obvious area by any means. In fact, if he called it live, people would have went, what? A lot of people, when the VAR started, assumed that it was the headed ball in that they were looking at, that there maybe was a foul over the defender there. And that was even the player that was complaining. I think the Atlanta fans or Atlanta players were caught off guard by this thing being called back. It was just a strange, strange call that you never see made. Is it by the letter of the law offside? I suppose, maybe, but the offside rule, as we know, is up for interpretation at the best of times. And it really needs to be a little more black and white. I mean, I would much prefer it to go back to the old school way, where if you just, you can't be in an offside position, when the, you know, that player would have been automatic left side, it wouldn't be a question. But this new kind of like interpretation thing is ridiculous to me.
I just want to say to clear the rule for the listeners, if you're offside, you're offside, of course, right? That's not the point. But they only call the offside if you're involved in the play. Majority of the time, the person that's offside will be one of the one or two players will be offside, and they'll be dictating that play. Like we saw in the Portland game, the two players that were offside on that free kick are the ones that actually handled the ball and headed the ball and scored. But in this way, the player did not touch the ball, did not create the movement off the ball either to create a play that would feel involved in the game. He was, though, in front of the goalkeeper Guzan and in the play as a whole, but not involved in the play. And maybe that's the solution right there, Dwayne. If you're offside, you're offside. And that's where the rules finish. So you don't have to interpret anything.
And in the dark ages, when I played semi-competitively,
back in the black and white days.
Yes, exactly. That was the rule, and that was how it was called, and everyone just understood it. And then they changed it to this new one, and it, I think, for probably increased scoring was the idea behind it. And if that's the case, then, you know, I don't mind them allowing players to be in an offside position if they're not involved in the play, but then don't get into this, like, are you screening the goalie stuff? Because that, like, that's impossible to call with any determination. And again, from a VAR perspective, it is not a clear and obvious error. If you're going to overturn things that aren't clear and obvious, then take the damn language out of the law and don't try and pretend otherwise. That drives me insane.
And there's going to be like 8-9 VARs a game. Well, he gave him a red card. He gave him a yellow card, but the guy was like, he was just defending himself. Or we gave to the retaliation. Did we give to the first one? Yeah, if it's not a clear-cut error, I agree with you. But it's up for debate, that one, too, because maybe in the view of the video assistant referee, which we don't have any discussion on, because they don't talk, first of all. They don't answer questions. There's not a pool reporter that is allowed to ask them about why and what's the thinking behind that overturned decision. This is one of the deficiencies of VAR, is letting journalists, or at least one pool players, like for referees, to ask questions about VAR.
For sure. I've never understood why officials at a world-class level, and that's what they aspire to be. I mean, laugh if you want when I say world-class and pro referees at the same time, but when at a professional level at any rate.
World Cup veteran.
Yeah, I get why they don't want to have every single decision criticized, because that could get a little bit too much. But when a major thing happens, I think that they should be held a little more accountable to it. And I think at the very least, when major mistakes are made, that it should be obvious what happens, and they shouldn't just hide the punishment or the corrections that happen behind the scene. No one expects them to be perfect. In fact, I am the number one advocate for understanding that. I don't mind mistakes by referees. I think it's the human aspect of the game, and that's why I don't like VAR. I think we should accept that mistakes happen, but I don't like it when you have this technology that comes in that overturns the human decisions on the field that often are the common sense decisions. To me, that was a common sense goal. And the other thing to do, and this may be a segue us into the other game, when you talk about the Portland VAR correct offside, and it was a correct call. The reason I think it went to VAR, though, is because they're instructed now to not put the flag up when it's that close. And to me, that just creates confusion in the stadium.
Well,
let your assistants call the damn play.
Well, to be fair, the assistant did call the offside. So the assistant was sure, but they still went to VAR because there was a goal, so they could review it. And they saw that it was offside, too. But it does create confusion in a way, yes. But because if they do call it offside and he actually scores and it wasn't offside, you cannot overturn it on that point, because offsides are not a reviewable aspect. Goals are. So, and if he calls the offside first, there's a whistle. The goal doesn't count because the play is dead, which is not a reviewable aspect of the game. So that's the reasoning behind why they're instructed that if it's that close, let it play and we'll see if it is overturned on VAR.
Yeah, it's an inconsistent interpretation of it. Just let the assistants call the game. But this is a broken record that I've been playing for a while, and I'm losing the battle. I get it that we, because the technology is there, people want perfection, and I think that be careful what you wish for, basically. But I think the New York goal was unfortunate, and it did, I think, kill this series. Had that goal countered, I still think Atlanta's the heavy favorite in the second leg based on what I saw and the fact that they're two goals up. But at least there's a chance, whereas now this is going to be a game that I don't even know how we'll talk about it when it gets closer or later to the end of the week. But really, if you're New York, you enter that second leg, I guess you just try and nick one in the first half and hope is really what it comes down to. And you got to get you just got to make sure you don't give another one up. And that's the problem. You can't go too front foot forward on it. I think we kind of saw that. We're not going to talk about Chelsea Spurs today.
No, we're definitely not going to talk about Chelsea Spurs. Okay, please let me have my.
But I think we saw a bit of that with what was Chelsea going to do after they got down two so quick. Right? Is like if you open up too much, you're screwed. But anyway. Other game, though, Kevin, which was a very entertaining 0-0.
It was a chippy game. It was a very physical 0-0 game. Kansas City at Portland. It was a very... First of all, if you didn't get the reference, I didn't get the reference either, so I had to do some digging. It's an Eastbound and Down reference, a show that's on TV, or used to be on TV, that I've never watched, with actors that I don't
it's
know.
Okay.
It's okay?
It's okay.
Well,
yeah, it's okay.
We're back, and you're welcome.
There you go. It's it's kind of a fun show, but no, that they're getting increasingly more
meta
cute, which is what I've always said about Devo. But anyway, it was an entertaining game, but SKC, you got to be happy with that. Portland had the more of the play, I think, but later on, Russell especially had quite a few chances and flying them over the bar in that. But I think if you're Kansas City, you come out of that 0-0. You do have the goal that might have changed things, but it's not a goal. I mean, that one was clearly offside, as I said a minute ago. So
it was two players offside. And, in a perfect world, the VR did not exist, the linemen would have blown the play dead. So it turns out to be the same result after the play than it would have been.
Yeah, and I don't. In fairness to Portland fans, it's a little early yet, but I don't see any of them complaining online about it. I'm sure there are some. You can find some people complaining about anything everywhere. But
I was going to say there's always someone complaining about something in Portland.
But by and large, I think most of them in sober second thoughts when they see that replay are going to realize that that wasn't a legit goal. So. I wouldn't count Portland out in that one. It is the only game really on next weekend that we're going to mostly be paying attention to because the entertainment value is going to be a little higher because the game's in flux. But Kansas City played a road game and they got the job done. That's the only question I ever have is when you are on the first leg on the road, so you're the better team, assumedly, based on the regular season results. I don't understand why so many teams still choose to play the chippy defensive style. Well, Kansas City's a bit different in the sense that it's kind of how they play. But sometimes I see teams, and New York might have been guilty of this, that they sit back with this idea that we want the 0-0. Like, why? Go for the throat. Get a goal. That's going to put things a hell of a lot better off than even if you lose 3-2, for example, to pick a completely random score.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, 3-2, the advantage heading into the second leg. Like, it's try for goals, to me, is how you should approach this as the team in the first leg. Although I think this is the last year we're going to be talking about this. So, because I do think they are going to go to the single game situation for a lot of reasons. I think it's easier for them to sell tickets. I think it's easier for them to market. I think it's easier. It's fair competition-wise, and they're going to avoid cold weather. So it does make a lot of sense, as we talked about last week.
And that home field advantage will truly be one, which is now, over the last couple of years, the first leg on the road for the higher seeded teams have actually felt like a disadvantage. If you look at the stats, if you look at the amount of, I don't have it in front of me, but if you look at the amount of teams getting the advantage in the first leg and winning in the second is higher than the reverse. So there's that. And if you didn't get that 3-2 reference from Dwayne, it goes back to 2016, Montreal-Toronto, 3-0 at the Big O. For the first leg of the Eastern Conference semifinal. And late in the game, Toronto scores 2, finishes 3-2 when Toronto won the second leg. And it still hurts.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, it's more to the point to pick it in a general sense. Like, Toronto went in feeling that they could score goals, and they got goals, right? And those goals changed that series and made that second leg a lot more Well, I mean, Montreal got the lead in the second leg. We could write novels about that series, but by and large, it was trying to get out in the front foot.
You're a writer. I'm a blogger.
Both teams believed that they could score goals. That's ultimately why that series was so great. Neither team played it defensively, and it was crazy. So, yeah.
You got a pen. You got paper. I got pictures. I got a dictator phone. Let's get together and make a buck. Okay, maybe not. I'm lazy.
I could maybe do a podcast. We could do like an ESPN 30 for 30 kind of podcast on it. That's something more likely that we could pull off.
An ESPN 20 for 20. Hindsight.
Yeah. You can put it on 20. Well, what's the exchange rate on 30? It's like 36.95 to 36.95 or something.
Yeah, exactly. So it'll be fascinating that second game, 0-0 after the first one. But now it's time to move on to positives before we finish the show with a very, very high negative coming from the Copa Libertadores. This is coming from Uruguay, though. Same region of the world, but Canada versus Germany. It's the 82nd minute, going close to the 83rd. Itema is in the box. She gets the service. She left foot's open shot and scores. The game winner for Canada, who reaches the first ever semifinal U-17 Women's World Cup in their history, and they're going to face Mexico later this week in the semifinal.
Yeah, it's the first time Canada has been to a semifinal of a youth tournament ever. Second time they've been to a semifinal of a youth tournament ever. They obviously went to the final of the what was called the U-19s at the time in 2002, the start of the bronze generation. Was that silver medal that they got in Canada in the first ever U-19 tournament that eventually became the U-20 tournament for the women. But yeah, look, what I said last week, and I maintain this, after they lost 5-0 to Spain, which Spain looks damn good in this tournament, the European champions, and maybe the favorite at this point. I don't think it's a maybe, but they are the favorite at this point, certainly based on everything that's played for. That game in the end of the group stage, Canada rested five of their players and were forced to rest Jordan Heidemann. And I think that when Heidemann is not on the pitch, this team is just different. When you have the best player, and this goes for any sport really, but especially in the sport that we love, but when you have the best player on the pitch, you have a chance because that player can be, especially that player is an offensive player. And I think that maybe that is the key. When you have the best offensive player on the pitch, a game-changer offensive player, a player that is playing above her age, is maybe the best 17-year-old in the world right now, who's potentially dating maybe the other best 18 players
in the world now, Fonza Davies. Yeah, which has started training with Bayern Munich, but...
Yeah,
continue.
And half of the team that she was playing were Bayern Munich's women's youth team. So I suspect that we might know where she's going to end up. Maybe, although I'm not going to sit here and suggest that she's going to just blindly follow Alfonso. Teenage dating scenes are not our thing, but nonetheless, certainly there'd be an end there.
She did practice with PSG earlier this year, so there's always a bridge.
Which would be a better choice for her.
Yeah, it would. But, you know, the Bundesliga women, and we were actually criticized on social media last week because we don't talk enough of the Bundesliga women. And it's true, though. There's a lot of good teams in the Bundesliga women, Wolfsburg, to be one of the best in Europe, actually.
Sure, of course, yeah.
But it's out of sight, out of mind a bit for us because we don't see it as much as the other ones. So I guess.
And we have two Canadians playing on the PSG. Know, one Canadian playing on for City, which is, you know, obviously a team that I follow a little bit. And
Lyon and PSG,
And we have Lyon and PSG, so that's a little more front and center. And obviously the French teams have been very successful. But you are absolutely correct that the Wolfsburg in particular and the German teams in general have been leading edge of the women's game in Europe for a long time.
Which makes it even more interesting that Canada beat Germany in the U-17 Women's World Cup.
Yeah, the thing is about this game, and I actually I was primarily watching this game over the NY game. Because it was a first leg of a playoff, and this is a Canadian team playing in the quarterfinals, and I felt that was more important for me to be my primary focus game, with my secondary focus game being the MLS game. So I did watch this very closely, and the longer it went, the more surprising it was. And I was surprised by the fact that Germany wasn't taking things more on front foot, because generally speaking, that's what Spain did. Spain just went at Canada, and they made them look terrible at the back. Instead, what it looked like Germany was doing is they were trying to take Heidemann out of the game. They would swarm her whenever she had the ball. They were trying to deny her the ball. They were trying to let the rest of Canada beat them, so to speak. And that made it a much more defensive game from their game plan, and they just never got into it offensively. Canada had the 58% possession or something in this. Like, they were the deserving winners of this game. It wasn't a blowout by any means, but, and it wasn't, you know, Germany could have nicked one for sure. But by and large, this was a pretty confident performance by a Canadian team that looked, had their ass handed to them less than a week earlier, and suddenly they're looking at the potential of, you know, it's a game that's not going to be easy. Mexico was better than them in qualifying, but they have a chance to go to a final.
A CONCACAF final. Mexico, Canada, for a spot in the final of a World Cup.
U17, which would likely be against Spain, because
New Zealand, Spain? Are you kidding me? It's going to be like another 5-0 for Spain. But props to New Zealand for getting there.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's that was the biggest upset of the tournament, because Japan looked very, very technically solid throughout this tournament. Were my pick to win it, having watched a lot of the group stage. Unfortunately, I couldn't watch a lot of the quarterfinals, but I did actually watch a lot of this tournament, more than most people in the world. I would guess that I have watched more of this tournament than 99.8% of the world.
Well, so, it was fun because it was on TSN too. So either live or when I come back late from work, like I do, I come back home. Oh, wait. Japan versus something is on TV. I'm just going to put it there. Why not? All right. There's more people watching than in the stands, of course. But, yeah.
In general, real quickly, in the overall tournament, I think I spoke to this on Two Solitudes last week. It's actually been remarkable. And I've watched every version of the U17 tournament since they started it. And the change in the quality is just remarkable in the women's game. It's night and day.
I was just going to say, it's not Route 1 for the win all the time. The Spain win over Canada was surprising in the tiki-taka aspect of it. You looked at Germany's performance. You looked at New Zealand's performance. And New Zealand winning their first game with an amazing goal from about 30 yards out. Like, no, quality has been a very, very high factor in this tournament.
Yeah, no, and it's remarkable to see, and it's growing leaps and bounds. And I mean, we've talked about this a lot from Canadian perspective, how from the European perspective, that's where you really see a lot of the growth. And even the African teams in this tournament did quite well. It's you got to keep up, and I'm not sure Canada always is. And I do think that Heidema is papering over a lot of cracks in this roster. And I'm not saying this to be disrespectful to the young women that are making out the rest of that roster, but realistically, only one or two of them will ever be talked about beyond this tournament, which is why, you know, if you're looking at the semifinals and hopefully a final for this Canadian team, I think that you could just put aside all those questions about Rex and all those questions about things and just enjoy it for what it is. These girls have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to potentially play for a world championship. And for a bunch of Canadian girls in this sport, that is remarkable. And maybe it won't be easy to get back to again after this. So enjoy it for what it is, and congratulations to them. They have the best, I think, the best under 17 player in the world right now. Take advantage of it and go out and, hell, maybe you can turn it around against Spain. I have doubts, but maybe.
You know, I know you're not going to agree with this, but congratulations to Ryan Wilkinson, coach of the U17 Women's World Cup from Montreal. First two coach selected to be part of the Rex Coaching Excellence Program. And 2 years ago, actually in 2015, she was the first one, well, one of the first two, to transition from being a player in the Rex Elite Program to becoming a coach in that program. And even though with some controversy along the way, some difficult times along the way too, a lot of ups and downs as a coach, she has brought Canada, with the help of Jordan Heidema, of course, but she's a player in your team, so you kind of have to make it count. Canada's in the World Cup semifinal, so congratulations to Montrealer Ryan Wilkinson.
I don't disagree with that. I just my opinion on the naming of Wilkinson as the head coach with her first major coaching position is that not necessarily that I wished her ill will or thought that it was impossible that she could be successful. It's just that I feel that there wasn't really any understandable coaching search that happened, and you just handed it to an ex-player, which it's working out in this tournament, but you would hope that in the future that you would make sure that you were hiring the most qualified person possible for those positions. And it's, again, it might have been her, and I wish I had more trust that they went through a process and didn't just go the old girls network, right? Which is kind of what it sometimes feels like within the Canadian women's program, is nepotism and so on and so forth. But it's working out, so all the power to her. You look, I am, if you look deep into my sporting heart, and I have a lot of sporting passions, as anyone who knows me knows, anyone who follows me on Twitter knows, and I've been very lucky recently with them, but yeah. A Canadian World Championship would be something that would be beyond my expectation ever in my lifetime. So even if it happens at a U17 level, I'd be very happy to see that. So
yeah,
so that's just cheer them forward from this point.
Speaking of not happy to see what happened, let's move to the final topic on today's show: the Copa Libertadores and the fiasco surrounding the entire process. Boca Juniors on their way to the Monumental Stadium in River Plate. And the bus attacked by cans of beer, which is not the worst thing, rocks, bottle of full champagne, which I saw a video, the bottle missed the bus, went over the bus, and hit a fan of River Plate in the face with broken bones on that one. But yeah, a terrible situation. People could have died because the bus driver, scared for his life after receiving a rock in the window next to him and probably hit, was driving about 80 miles per hour in the streets to make sure he could get the players there safely. They could have ran over people. They might have. We don't know. Violence ensued between the police and riot squad and the River Plate fans, so they used tear gas, and that tear gas ended up in the bus. Some people in the crowd, because I'm not going to use the River Plate fans aspect, it was a crowd at that moment, and there's a mix of everybody, and there's people that put on the jersey and act differently, and it doesn't mean that you wear a jersey of a team that you're an actual fan of that team. You might just want to stir some up, and that probably happened. And you had people in the crowd taking those tear gas and throwing it at the bus. Some of them got in. The smoke was in the bus. Players were affected. The captain, Pablo Perez, had injuries to his eye, and the game was delayed, and then postponed to the next day. And then on the next day, the game was delayed, and finally postponed indefinitely. First of all, here's a question. Was the decision to postpone it on Sunday the right one?
Oh, yeah.
Like, half the team couldn't play.
I don't think they should play the game in Buenos Aires at all. I think it should be played behind closed doors in a neutral site, and they shouldn't announce where the neutral site is until it happens. Honestly, they should play it in Houston and tell people the morning of. Like, it'll be on TV, but we're not going to tell you where it's being played, and we'll just fly them somewhere. Like, I mean, honestly, they can't be trusted at this point. And when I say they, I'm talking the general, capital T, they.
Yeah.
I'm not blaming River or Boca fans for this, or even River or Boca ultras for this, although I am going to blame ultra culture a little bit for it, because especially in South America, the ultra culture has, you know, maybe ruined it for a lot of people. It's certainly hurt the quality of the game down there, because the ultra groups have, in many cases, they're not the same as what you find in a supporters group here, even a supporters group that calls themselves ultras here. Like down there, they're attached to organized crime half the time. Like, it's not pleasant stuff that goes
and
on.
Violence is okay for them. We clearly saw that on Saturday. And the violence continued in the streets for a long, long time. After the game was canceled on Saturday and they were evacuating the Monumental, it wasn't easy. Like, it was still pretty violent and very, very tense. And the comments, like, there were children and people in the crowd before the game that got injured for no reason and no fault of their own. And it's terrible. Like, imagine if one of the players of Boca or River Plate, if the situation is inverted, dies in the bus because he receives a full bottle of champagne on the temple. It's not a good look.
Or if the bus driver passed out, apparently, and he crashed the bus into a crowd. Like, I mean, lots of bad things could happen.
You could have, like, hundreds of deaths that happens, too, Instead of hitting one of those high corner turns that he did, high-speed turns, imagine if he's passed out because he received it and just the bus is going 50 miles an hour and straight for the crowd. It's terrible.
When I was watching this stuff play out, I was mostly watching it on Twitter. I was planning to watch the game like many people in the world, and I was looking forward to seeing it because everyone wants to see the passion. not the violence, but the passion that happens in South America. But I think as I was watching this and watching this play out, what was crossing my mind is this could be the beginning of the end of ultras. Honestly, and it's not going to happen overnight, but there's been they've had so much control over the game in South America for so long, and in other parts of the world, in Eastern Europe as well, you'll see it a lot and a lot of problems there too. But this happened in front of the world. This happened with the New York Times was there. This happened with TV cameras on it, and it embarrassed a lot of people. You have a G20 summit that's going down there soon, a G8 summit or something.
Next week?
One of those summits.
Yeah. G20. And that's
so you have
why
world leaders down there.
That's why it couldn't be transferred to next weekend, because of the G20 and all the security aspect of the entire country is busy protecting the G20 from what will be protests and from what will be the head of states of the G20 itself. And there is no security and police available to assure security for a rematch of the game. So that's why it was postponed indefinitely.
Yeah, and when it's got to happen soon, because the Club World Cup happens.
It might happen. It might happen like a week or two. It might happen in Abu Dhabi. That's one of the actual rumors now, that it could happen just a few days before they fly both teams to Abu Dhabi. They have that match, and the winner goes on to continue in that tournament right there, and the other one just goes back home.
Which isn't the worst idea that I've heard. But again, to go back to my original point, that a level of embarrassment might be the impetus that starts people to really take it seriously, to try and get some control back. No one wants to take the passion away. Famously, you'll see ultras groups that are in more calm parts of the world will say, there's no football without ultras and stuff like that. You'll see banners like that. And it's true to a point. There's no ultras. There's no football without fans. But this is why I resist any group that puts that name attached to them. It's come on, man. There's problems there. It's hooligan. Why would you call yourself hooligan? And no one does in Europe anymore. And the European game has been sanitized at the top leagues in terms of your crowd experience. And they priced them out, and they've basically taken back control of the stadiums. And a lot of people are trying to push back now on the fan side of things to get a little bit more control in there. And I think MLS in many ways gets it perfect, in the sense that you do have the ability to have a little bit more of a passionate time in certain parts of the section with some rules that are a little laxer than others. And I know that frustrates people here, and there have been problems. Famously, we saw problems in Ottawa this year with the group from Manny Brody from TFC. But
we saw problems over the years in Montreal and San Jose and Toronto. In any place in Major League Soccer, we saw some problems, but because of the contingency plans and the security aspect that they have put in place, especially cameras on the supporters section, and be able to identify the culprits and be able to act upon them and blame a whole group or blame a whole section, and then there's ramifications to it. They were able to control and not escalate the problem to a point where it becomes dangerous for the safety of fans inside the stadium or out. And when there was episodes of people getting beat up, severe sanctions were taken. And it's something that is not happening in South America.
Yeah, and look, again, this will not happen quickly, but I truly believe that the level of embarrassment, the level of intention that has happened to this, and this is being talked about on mainstream stuff all over the world, might create some impetus to change. And finally, they might get a little bit of the stadium back, and that might result in actions being taken that start to squeeze out some of those fans. And that'd be a shame in some cases, because a lot of the ways that you squeeze fans out when the violent aspects, their violent minority, starts to cause too many problems, is you start to price them out, which that prices out all of the people that are, even the ones that are well-behaved, right? And I think you've seen that with a lot of European, or a lot of English clubs for sure, whereas, some of those clubs that were famous for their bad behavior back in the days are buried down in the lower leagues and have a fraction of their old support. Stadiums that were once known for the rowdy atmospheres are, you have to sit nicely, and it's like going to an NHL game, basically. If you've ever been to a Premier League game, you'll know that, it's really halfway through, you realize you're just like any other North American sporting experience, other than you're watching some great soccer in front of you. But yeah, it'd be a shame to lose it completely. But at the same time, you can't have crap like that happen. And to me, that's an example of complete laissez-faire and pandering to violent elements, or being frightened of violent elements, for far too long. And even if you look at obviously I don't read Spanish very well at all, but from what I can take from the Spanish coverage that I've sort of pieced together through both, you know, my own limited understanding of the language and doing translation things, it's they're ripping into it in Argentina too. This is not like, you know, Argentina go, oh, you just don't understand our culture. These are Argentinians going like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah,
our country's been embarrassed.
They had the most historical final of finals for their Champions League, Copa Libertadores, with the two most famous club in Argentinian soccer. And they effed it up.
And real quickly, it's two Division II Argentine teams from Buenos Aires just a week before had their derby, and riots happened there too. So this is not isolated to Boca and River. This is a problem in Argentina football, in Argentina football club culture, where the ultras, where the violent element, are taking too much control. And I just can't help but think that this might be the beginning to the end of that, and that might be, you know, that obviously there would be problems whenever you try and squeeze elements like that out. There'll be problems in the initial start, but eventually the authorities will win because they have more power, and that will be a detriment ultimately to those that just want to enjoy the game and have legitimate passion for their teams. And no one wants to take that away, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on the situation. We'll let you know when the game is played and how it will happen, and hopefully we can actually watch the game too to see who wins this derby that would have been. It's a derby that would have been something special, and now it's just something tragic. On that note, we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Soccer Today, the world of football with a soccer perspective. You can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute and myself at Kev Larame, the show at Soccer Today SBN, which you can catch the live video portion of the show on our Twitter feed at Soccer Today SBN. Thank you for your patronage if you're a patron of the show at patreon.com/sports. Podcast Network. $2 a month will give you access to the Two Solitude Soccer Podcast, Canadian soccer only. Make sure when you sign up, or if you haven't been to the website in a few weeks, and if you're not able to get the show by podcast over the last few weeks, go to patreon.com/sportspodcastnetwork. Make sure that the box that says Two Solitudes tier is clicked, and then you will get your access as well to the exclusive content that we produce once a week, usually on Thursdays. And as always, until tomorrow, have a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.